aliens and flying saucers.
This is all in a loop.
Hey, welcome to the 110th episode of Two Writers Slinging Yang. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, former ESPN columnist, and the author of multiple New York Times bestsellers. The music you're listening to is Croissants from the great MC White Owl. And this podcast is an ode to writing in all its forms, from sports writing to screenwriting to music critique and self-help to song lyrics to whatever genre I'm thinking of. And today's episode stars Tim Layden, the all-time fantastic Sports Illustrated writer who recently announced he was leaving the magazine after 25 years. And there's a lot to talk about here with one of the most intense and hard-nosed reporters on the planet. The plight of magazines, learning to write, enduring a terrifying run-in with a drug-addicted Yankee reliever. So chill, kick back, and join me for another episode of Two Writers Slinging Yang.
All right, Tim, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. It's kind of weird because we had about a six-year crossover at Sports Illustrated, but I'm not sure if we were ever in the same building more than two times, maybe, ever.
If that. It's always been a weird place that way. And, I mean, there were people that I overlapped with that I never met. It's very weird that way and always has been. And probably most of media is that way now. You know, yeah. Nobody goes to an office anymore. So I guess in one of many ways that SI was ahead of the curve.
I decided to have you here because, for many reasons, you announced a couple of days ago via social media that you were leaving Sports Illustrated. And I had no idea. And you issued it was interesting because I just read before your statement that you issued or that you put out on Twitter. You wrote something and I kind of caught my eye and I was thinking about it. You wrote, I'm deeply proud of the quality of work that we produced and which the magazine and website continue to produce. People who have derided the relevance of modern SI have not been paying attention. Great writers lost have been replaced by other great ones. The battle does not get easier, but I am confident that my once and former colleagues at SI are ready to fight it and I'll be rooting for them every day. And I love SI as much as anybody. I love the magazine. I loved working at the magazine, considered the greatest sort of period of my writing career. But I do wonder, can magazines still have the relevance? It hurts me to ask, do people care anymore?
I don't know for sure. And when I say relevance, I guess I'm kind of kicking back at that the term that you see thrown around in certain places on the internet about SI is often irrelevant.
Yeah.
And, by saying what I said, and obviously, I do have tremendous affection for SI. It's same as with you. And I was there a lot longer. I mean, that's going to be, whenever I shuffle off, it's going to be the first paragraph of my obit, so it's been, it was just I can't even describe how great it's been for me. But in terms of, I was trying to say that the work that people are producing at SI and SI.com, while I don't love all of it, and I think SI and SI.com have made some terrible business decisions. I think editorially, if you add it all up, the quality of the work is as good as anywhere. Now, relevance is a super tricky word because you're never going to go back to what SI was in the 70s or 80s, where it wasn't just relevant, it was towering. I mean, it was like the first and last word on everything, or certainly the last word on everything. You weren't big until SI profiled you, and the game wasn't played until SI published a game story about it. And we're never going back to that. But my point was that SI still does great work, and it's not fair to trot out a Dan Jenkins college football story or, a huge investigative piece and say, well, they're not doing this anymore. Well, nobody's doing the same things they were doing 20 or 30 years ago. Everything is hugely, hugely just tectonically different than it was then. So there's no real basis for comparison. But to grab a random copy of SI from 1981 and say, well, they're not this good anymore, it's not fair. And there's plenty of good people working at SI now doing terrific work and the brand struggles in a lot of ways, just like every other brand is, to try and find a way to stay alive. And that's all I was trying to say.
It's funny. I was thinking about you as a writer and your time at Sports Illustrated. And the word I kept thinking, and this is going to sound weird, so I got to elaborate, is underrated. right? Because I feel like, well, I look back at my time at SI, and you obviously you had Riley and you had Gary Smith, and they were kind of the big stars, the flashy big stars, and they were tremendous. And you had Russian, who was kind of young upstart, you know, and then you would have different people come up the pipe and you'd have different people brought in. And there's this thing where Tim Layden probably wrote more than any other writer. You were freaking dogged as fuck. I mean, you were the most, and am I exaggerating that point, or am I exaggerating the point when I say that sort of doggedness and going for the extra detail and going for the extra fact are kind of the hallmark of what you've done?
I guess so. Let me tell you a story. I remember being at the 2004 Olympics, and it was back, you know, 2004 was one of the last Olympics. Maybe 2008 was really the last one where SI sent like an army of people to the Olympics, I've been to every Olympics that SI, since I got to SI. I've been to 14, total and 12 for SI. And it's, you know, in the last Winter Olympics, we had two riders. But in 2004, we had like 12. Mm-hmm. And that was also the very early days of digital media, so that, you know, SI.com existed, but it was something that was belittled by a lot of people. You know, people made fun of it. And I'm talking about SI writers making fun of it.
Yeah.
And there was one day when I came back to the office after being like at the track or at the swimming pool like all day and picking up this kind of featurey thing I wanted to do and writing it at the pool. And then coming back into the office, and it's like, it's Athens and it's 100 degrees and super humid. And I took the shuttle bus, and I just come walking in, and I just threw my stuff down on the table and in the office. And Rick Riley, God bless him. You know, Riles made a life and a career for himself at SI that's kind of unlike anybody else. And he turned around and he just said, "What's going on? Yeah, you look like you're exhausted." And I said, "I am exhausted. I've been out in the sun. I've been chasing stuff down. I've been, you know, banging out shit on deadline." And he said, "Hey, you're killing yourself, man. You know, it's what's the story today?" And I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Yeah, that's this, that, and you just bang it out, and you know, you're just." And I said, "Rick, no, that's what you would have done." I said, I don't do this job the same way you do. You know, I can't." I said, "If I was you, I would do exactly what you just said. I would have just, you know, written my back page column for the magazine today, and then I'd go out and drank ouzo. But that's not the way I'm wired. I have to have my shit together before I write. And I have to know that the story's complete and that I've done everything I can do, and then I'll write it. And that's just, you know, that's, you solve the problem different ways. But that's, to me, that was a very illustrative moment. And, you know, it kind of made me realize what you just said. But at the same time, you know, I think in the last 10 years of my career, I kind of figured out how to write also. It didn't, you know, I developed a voice and a way to go at a story and a way to slowly here and there inject myself into things and use my voice and use my life and writing experience. But always to make sure that I had all my, that came at the very end after I had everything I could get, to tell the story. And that's just, you know, that's why I've always covered a lot of different things, because I was never dependent upon, you know, being connected to certain people. I could never have been that guy that covered baseball for 40 years. I mean, I liked doing different stuff, which was like kryptonite for a lot of people, because it meant walking into rooms where you didn't know anybody. But to me, that was always a cool thing. So, I mean, you're not totally wrong. I mean, I guess that's what I am, but I think I learned to write over time at the same time. You know, whenever I go talk to students or someone calls me up, I just say, you got to report, you know. Now, unless you're in that like 0.01% that can just fool people for a whole career, you're going to have to learn to ask people questions and research and outline and sit in a room by yourself and all that other horrible shit. And then you can sling some bad verbs if you want, but you got, you know.
Wait, I was going to say, so you, because you spent, all right, correct me if I'm wrong, you had 9 years at the Schenectady Gazette, you had 3 years at the Albany Times Union, you had 6 years in Newsday, you got 25 years in at SI, and you're saying within the last 10 years, you learned how to write?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote plenty of good stories with plenty of good stylizing and all that in those previous 30 years we're talking about, but you know, that's like kind of blind squirrel finding nuts sort of stuff. If you know the language and you've read a lot of writing, you can write a good story. You can really hit the language once or twice or frequently. But I didn't really become confident that I could do that consistently until the last 10 years. You know, it was just, wow. I think I was a perfectly fine writer for a lot of those years, probably better than a lot of writers. But again, it all was done. I was a better reporter by far. And then only in the last, you know, I pick a number. I mean, I said 10, but it might have been 6 or it might have been 13, but gradually figuring out how to take the reporting. And to me, you know, there's a difference between, I had a friend, Neil Best, who's, I'm sure you know Neil, but you worked with him at Newsday. I know you were on CitySide. He's a media reporter, really one of the brightest and most taciturn guys I know in the business. And he sent me a note once and said, the thing I like about your work is that you're doing fancy writing that makes the story better instead of fancy writing for the sake of fancy writing. And, and I think that's what I had to figure out is like, how do you write and try to elevate the writing, but not have Deadspin say you're just a bullshitter or something, you know, that you're too purple. And to me, it was all about just grinding and being a good reporter and then gradually becoming more confident in the reporting so that I'm confident that I got this story nailed. So now I can kind of tell it with my own voice as opposed to what maybe I did earlier in my career, which is like having the reporting, but now trying to like come up with a clever line. Like I had a whole period at the Albany Times Union where I tried to write like Jim Murray, you know, everything was like one line, bing, 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 one liners, like kind of like Riley was Jim Murray Jr. And, you know, I tried to do that for a while and it wasn't particularly very good. So, so what I'm saying is I haven't figured out how to put all the shit together until the last few years, you know, of my career, you know, and to me, that's a good thing. It should take a long time to figure this out. You know, it's not easy.
It's just interesting because I think a lot of people would assume you get to Sports Illustrated. Like I remember when I was young at SI and people would be like, you know, Peter King, that guy can't write, or Peter Gammons. People would be like, Peter Gammons, that guy's a sucky writer. And I'd be like, he can't be that bad because he's writing for Sports Illustrated. So he can't be that bad, you know, it's weird for me to picture a guy actually thinking I'm really not that good of a writer while seeing his name as a senior writer at Sports Illustrated.
I guess, but it's also, you know, like with all the stuff we're talking about, you know, we're talking within the universe of people, you know, like when I got to SI, Knack was still there. Lee Montville was still there. McCallum, you know, Farber had just gotten there. Scott Price and I came in together. Silver came in after that. You came in a little while after that. Alex Wolf was there. I mean, it's a bunch of people that could seriously bring it. And, and you know, I think in that, and when I was at Newsday, there were Verducci was there. John Sohn was there. You know, people that are very good wordsmith or very good reporters. Some of them were both. And, you know, to me, it was always, and again, this served me well, too. I never felt like I was this shit. You know what I mean? I was always scared that I was going to get fired, that the story wasn't good enough. And, you know, I was, and that always kept me working at it because, you know, whereas a guy, I don't know how Ryle felt when he sat down, but a guy like him probably felt like, you know, hey, if I don't have it nailed here, I'm funny enough to get away with this anyway. And actually when Riley was at his best was when he was doing really good reporting to back up his stories, or maybe someone else was doing a lot of that reporting for him. But that was when he was really good, is when he wasn't just trying to come up with 1,000 words of puns, you know? Right. So when I say I just would read Lee Motvill and just, you know, or Knack or DeFord and those people and say, I got a ways to go to get there. And I'm not saying I could read something that I wrote 25 years ago and some of them were really good. But, you know, it wasn't consistent. I wasn't confident. That's all I mean is I just think I had a lot to learn along the way. It's one of the things that's happened with the whole digital revolution and everything is there's a lot of super talented young writers coming up who really need to think they're not as good as they are. You know, that's another illness altogether, you know, it comes from a lot of sources.
You know, it's funny. I always say, so I teach journalism and, you know, I'm sure you do too. You have young journalists ask you, what should I do? What should I do? And I always maintain, even now, like especially now more than ever, if you want to stand out from other people, just report the hell out of a story and you'll immediately seem better than 99% of the other people out there. You know, it's the ultimate. I would say there's always going to be a better writer. There's a better writer than Riley. There's a better writer than Gary. There's always a better writer out there. But you can control how well you report a story.
Yeah, big time. And that's all that makes a story good is, I mean, there's just how many stories do you read in the course of a year that you remember and pass along to people and that really stop you in your tracks purely on the language? I mean, it's like happens to me like once a year, you know, that something is so good. If there's nothing in it, if there's no new information, or I'm not talking about news. I just mean like, you got a subject that you're attacking and it might be a thing or a game that was once played or a civic issue. And you're trying to write that. If there's not detail and reporting in there, man, you're going to lose people. That's not enough. And I think the people that can do that and then also elevate that material with really good writing, you know, that's when you get into that really upper echelon of people that are providing the words. When you can put those things together. And I also think, you know, newspapers don't exist anymore. So we're losing that whole training ground. But, you know, for me, I had to do that in 500 words first and then 800, then 1200. You know, I hear from a lot of super bright, talented young writers that say, I really want to write long form features. That's what I really want to do. And, you know, I'm always like, I'm sure you're brilliant, but you really should write short first. You know, because it's like that's how you learn. Like a long form story is just a bunch of short stories stitched together with some decent transitions. So but that's the way it went for me. I mean, when I was first started, it was, you know, you had a page or 500 words or whatever, and you just had to cram a lot of shit into that space. And that taught me how to use the material. And then as I went on and on, I tried to find a voice to go with it.
That's funny. I meet a lot of there's a quote I just read the other day from Margaret Atwood, and she was a brain surgeon. She was at a party and a brain surgeon said, when I retire, I want to write a novel. And she said, that's funny. When I retire, I'm going to start operating on people's brains. And I always think when you see like the 22-year-old who's like, yeah, I just really want to write long form features. Like you got to walk before you can run there, buddy. You know, there is something to this. It is not the easiest thing in the world.
Yeah, no kidding. And, but again, people see other people doing it and that's the other thing. Like, you can't stumble onto a successful brain surgery. You know, you can't just walk in and do that. But somebody with even a modicum of skill can stumble onto a really good long feature. But then doing it again and again and again is a different thing altogether. You know, if you find really good material and you have a halfway decent editor, you shouldn't be able to fuck it up. But, you know, doing that repeatedly is harder. You know, that's the thing. I mean, for me, it was like, you know, the last story I wrote for SI was on John Peters, that high school kid from 1989. I had good material, but, you know, as long as I've been doing this, when I sat down at my little dark office to write that story, it's like you take that big, deep breath and it's like, okay, here we go. You know, it's not any easier the last time than it is the first time, you know, because it's like it's a blank slate. You don't have anything to stand on. You know, it's like you're starting over every time, like just like with all the books you do. You know, like just because you wrote Gunslinger, that doesn't make the next one, you know, or, you know, Showtime, which I don't remember which one came first. But either way, it's like you're just got an empty screen, an empty notebook and empty digital files. And it's all new, which is a good thing. The best thing about the job and the worst thing.
Yeah, I agree. Wait, so you just referenced a story. You wrote did you know this was going to be your final SI story when you were working on it?
Pretty good idea. Yeah.
For the Where Are They Now issue, John Peters, who 30 years ago was on the cover of Sports Illustrated as a schoolboy, Brenham High School in Texas, super kid. He was a pitcher. You wrote basically sort of a catching up with on him, and it was freaking great. Your lead was, there he is on the cover of Sports Illustrated 30 years ago last spring, May 8th, 1989. He's on a pitcher's mound, rearing back with the baseball in his right hand, his left foot in the air, his pink face bathed in sunlight beneath the green cap of Brenham High. His tongue is squeezed between his lips. Above his head, a single word in yellow capital letters, Super Kid. Never before had a high school baseball player been featured on the cover of SI. Like, that's great. There's no one who could hear that and think like, oh yeah, this guy 10 years ago couldn't write. Like, I'm not even buying it. So this story, my one regret at SI is I never got to write for the catching up with issue. It's kind of my favorite thing. This was I thought it was a great story about a guy who's really had struggles over the 30 years since he was on the cover of SI. I don't know. What were the complications of her? What are the things that stand out from this piece for you?
Yeah. I'll give credit. A young guy who's a producer at SI.com, Connor Grossman, brought this to Adam Duerson, who edits the Where Are They Now issue, and Duerson asked me if I had any interest in doing. He didn't know then that it would be my last story, but I agree with you. I love writing for Where Are They Now, because as long as you, I mean, I'm not up for doing, like, we had A-Rod on the cover, and I haven't read the piece by Ben Reiter. It's probably great, but I had no interest in doing catching up with A-Rod. But when the guy's really obscure and as I got older, I got more drawn to people that have had life experience and have stories to tell. One of the reasons I enjoy covering horse racing is because it tends to be full of people that have had big ups and downs in their life. So with this one, I just, John is on social media. That's how you can often find people that way. I sent him a Facebook message. He sent me his cell phone number. I called him and, you know, he was up for it and went down there and it was pretty straightforward. I met him in Houston. He picked me up at my hotel. We drove out to his hometown, which is an hour and a half away, talked the whole time, you know, went to the ice cream factory where a lot of people in his town work, went to the high school where he grew up, went to the field where he set that record. And, he was super open about everything. You know, he's a guy who's in recovery and talking is something that people in recovery do. And it's good for him and it's good for my story. And, you know, it was just very cool. And he got emotional and upset a couple times and, you know, remembering what he went through. It was, you know, in terms of collecting the material, it was pretty straightforward, you know, but then once you get it, you want to do the right service to the subject. You know, I mean, again, we don't write for the subject. We write for the readers. But in this case, you know, I knew that this guy also isn't a public figure. He poured his guts out to me and I feel entrusted with that material and I want to write it with dignity and fairness, but also engage the reader. So there's a little bit of a line to walk there. But I, again, once I had everything reported and transcribed in front of me, and then, you know, I think I wrote it in 2 days. I thought I shouldn't fuck this up. This is pretty good. You know, but that is always the way I look at the material. Like if it's really good material, I'm not excited. Like this is a can't miss. I'm like, okay, it's up to you not to make it miss now. You know, it's right. Like, you know, how high and how quickly do you get to this one anecdote? How far do you bury this other anecdote that's important but not that interesting? You know, you just, to me, those are the great questions that, you know, mechanically I love dealing with when you're writing, but they drive you nuts. You know, you just, how soon do I have to get to this? You know, can I make the reader wait and wait and wait? Am I going to lose them? Attention spans are so short now, you can't really go with a slow burn too often. So it's, all that's fascinating, but you know, it just, you leave a little bit of your heart in every one of them. And, you know, it's, then there's a finite number you can do, I guess.
Do you actually take the readers into account? Like, are you thinking, I don't want to lose the reader too early. I don't want to this to the reader. Cause that never enters my mind and maybe it should.
It's actually more and more as I've gotten further into my career, because I know that I've learned that people's reading habits change. You know, I had a conversation with Wright Thompson about this. He hates pyramid style writing, which, you know, the writers are listening to this, but, you know, essentially front loading your story with all the good stuff and then maybe just kind of like sleepwalking for a little while and then hitting them with a big kicker. And his view is always, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to dole out the good stuff a little bit at a time all the way through the story. And I love doing it that way, but I firmly believe, and I know from the way I read stories, that you got to give people something soon. You know, yeah. You got to make them, why am I reading here? This is getting slow. It's nice that that's a beautiful sunset this dude described and the car we're driving in and the lunch and now we're five paragraphs in and what the hell is this story about? I do try and have a meter in my own head that when do I have to give them something that's going to keep them going? You know, what would I want here? Do I want to hear something juicy high in the story? That's sort of the crutch that I lean on is I feel like I have to give people something pretty soon to keep them going, you know, and it's just a matter of how much and then how long can I get away from it before coming back to it? You know, and, you know, you never know if you hit it right, but that's kind of what I settled on quite a while ago is that I'm going to tease the good stuff pretty early in the story. Cause I don't want you to think that I'm making you wait for nothing.
If I'm a rival reporter from Tim Layden, and we're both covering the Kentucky Derby or something, and I'm writing for whatever, whoever, ESPN, the magazine, you're writing for SI or whatever publication, am I going to hate you? Am I going to be like, God, this guy freaking is just like as competitive as hell? Or are you not? Because I kind of, I was that way for a very long time as a writer, where I was just like, I'm not giving you anything. You are my enemy. At the Tennessean, I was the worst ever. I mean, I would not. And I wonder, are you that way? You're kind of like, look, this is my job. And should reporters be that way?
I think it falls into a couple categories. In some areas where I've covered a lot of stuff, like track and field or horse racing or skiing, swimming to a certain degree, and then, you know, like college football, when I did that, you know, there would be plenty of times when somebody would approach you and say, hey, can you just kind of give me the lay of the land here? You know, like in terms of the mechanics of the job, like where should I go to see this guy? Or, you know, like what time is the press conference? And especially in a sport like horse racing or even track and field, where it's kind of a three ring circus and it can be very disorienting to know where to go to find information. I'm happy to help. You know, I remember 3 or 4 years ago, I was covering a Preakness and a writer from ESPN was there, and it was her first horse race she had ever covered. And she's very good. It was Heather Dinnett. She's a very, very good reporter and writer. I mean, she doesn't need my help, but she was just out of her element. And on the first day of Preakness week, she came up to me and just said, so I talked to a friend and I said, how do I cover the Preakness? And they said, just find Tim Layden and follow him around. And I was totally cool with that. Because I think, you know, at some point, you know, we're all kind of in this together, you know, and obviously if I have, information that's going to make my story better when I write it, I'm not going to share that information. But in terms of how you get around and do the job, I'm totally happy to help, because it's just, people have helped me, you know. Right. It's, you know, you just need to be pointed in the right direction. And I, you know, if I'm worried that I help some young writer on a beat that I'm familiar with, and by helping them, they're going to kick my ass in their story, then I should retire. You know, I should have enough resources to do the job well and still help people. So I hope that people have, it's a weird thing, Jeff, about, you know, like announcing you're retiring from a job on Twitter as people say shit about you, then, you know, and most of it's very nice and I was totally overwhelmed by it, but, you know, people are talking about dogged reporter, tireless, you know, never quits. And I thought, Jesus, I've tried to do the job well, but was I an asshole? You know, I hope I wasn't, you know, but right. I'm sure, as you know, when you get in the trenches, sometimes you're going to like shout a couple extra questions, or you're going to push somebody aside without, you know, you just get, you know, it's, again, people think that we sit around and write, but when you're out in the field covering stuff, it's almost a physical activity. You know, you're trying to get from a locker to another locker, or, you know, a source to another source, and there's a chance to piss people off. And I hope I haven't done that too often, you know, in trying to gather what I needed to write a story.
Did you have to overcome ever in your life the sort of nervousness of asking the question, the nervousness of entering an unfamiliar locker room?
Still doing that stuff. Totally.
Are you?
Totally. Totally. It's not, you know, I saw you answer a Twitter question once to somebody who said, you know, is it hard to ask questions? And your answer was something like, fuck yeah, all the time. It's an awkward job. You know, it's like, it's, you know, yeah, totally. I get nervous for every interview still. Yep. You know, it's just, you should get nervous because you're, you know, you have, it's this incredible gift that you have this freedom, this like credit card to ask people anything you want. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, like one of the stories I reprised lately, because this distance runner, Gabe Grunwald, passed away. And, you know, and I interviewed her 2 years ago for a big, long story, and she was dying then. And she knew it, and I knew it, and she knew that I knew, and I knew that she knew. But then I just put it aside and asked her a whole bunch of very invasive questions, because that's the only way you can tell the story. And once you get through the first few, it's easier, you know, the first few questions in any interview. But I'm definitely, you know, I don't have trouble diving in, but, you know, I get butterflies every time, because it's hard. It's hard to, it's not hard. It's uncomfortable. you know, to, right. to not everybody is prepared for it, you know? So it's you try and find your own way of doing that part of the job so that people are okay with you. And, you know, it's just everybody, it's, you just work with your own personality and how you do it. And I hope one thing I've tried to do is not interrogate people, you know, throughout, unless you get in situations where you have to, but when I'm doing feature writing or just, you know, whatever enterprise reporting, you just try to treat people like they're just somebody you're having a beer with or a coffee with and ask straightforward questions.
Well, the story you just referenced, it came out in 2017. Athlete gets cancer. Athlete fights cancer. Repeat again and again. Was ridiculously good. I mean, really freaking good. Here's this woman. She's battling cancer nonstop. She's aware that her mortality is sort of on the brink. How do you ask someone questions about dying when they're dying and you're not?
I think I didn't know how much I was going to ask her about that. But I spent, you know, probably 5 days total with her and her husband and her family. I didn't really ask her the really hard questions. Like, hey, do you think about the things you're, I remember sitting in the lobby of her apartment and saying, do you think about the things you might not get to do? Mm-hmm. And she just said, I wanted to be a mom. I'm never going to be a mom. There's places I'm never going to go. And it was hard, man. I mean, all I could think was, I mean, this is like anybody reading this story. There was a cheerful spin on the story in that she's still fighting. But if you read every quote in it from every medical professional, you would have come away realizing that her odds were not good. And I just knew that anybody reading that story is going to want to know those things. So I had to find a way to ask eventually. It just took few days of being around her to get to the point where I was comfortable putting those things on the table. And I also knew by then how tough and strong she was and that she would handle it okay. I mean, I was closer to crying than she was when I was talking. I mean, you know, cause she was just straightforward and, you know, would throw a little humor into all of it. And it just was kind of overwhelming that, you know, we do this a lot as writers. When you interview people, you get so caught up in the process of asking the questions and getting the quotes and getting the story, then you need to step back and say, wow, this is an amazing person in one way or another, whether it's a great athlete or somebody who's dying or somebody who's, has accomplished a lot of different things despite ups and downs. And then you have to step back when it's all done and kind of assess your subject. And like, you know, with her, it built over a few days that I came to have this great respect for her toughness and strength and worldview, you know, and that she held on to right till she died. You know,
It's interesting. I always think one thing that people forget in this business, myself included, I'm sure you do at times too, is just what a incredible honor it is that these people let you in their lives and share intimate details that they wouldn't share oftentimes with an uncle or a sister or whoever. You know, it's a remarkable perk of this business, don't you think?
And why do they do it?
Yeah, I don't know. You know,
that's the thing that amazes me sometimes is when you're doing a feature and you're pushing and pushing and asking things and people keep answering. And sometimes it's my job to ask these things. And I know at this point what I have to ask to make to build my story. But it is an amazing thing that people look at you and decide that, well, this is a person who's going to tell my story. So I'm going to tell him my story. And I've only had my own experience of doing that. So I don't know how other people do that job or if they have more trouble doing it and get less response from people. But, you know, I'm amazed to this day that people open up the way they do and say things the way they do. I mean, you have one of the great stories of all time of someone doing that. And I know it's a seminal moment in your career that you've revisited, but, you know, obviously, you know, John Rocker either wanted to get those things out or didn't realize he was talking to a reporter or didn't understand how the business works. But whatever it was, he said those things. And that's a type A example of people just talking to a reporter, you know, and I do think there are people who talk to a reporter and don't understand how it's going to look in print. And I do think there are people that, are happy because they get a chance to talk to somebody in ways that they might otherwise never get a chance to. And, that's when we get back to that, the trust factor where you have to be mindful of their story, when it comes time to tell it.
Right. You, you did a piece in 2007. This is great. And this is apparently before you were a good writer. So the writing is just stopped. I've just learned 10 minutes ago, but you did a piece about Kevin Everett, who was a Buffalo Bills tight end who was paralyzed in a game. And on September 9th, 2007, you wrote this piece a couple months later. Your lead was, every step is precious now. Every moment is a gift. Every morning brings another sunrise full of sweet promise. When Kevin Everett was a little boy growing up in Port Arthur, Texas, he would sit with his grandpa, James Nico, and the older man would explain to him life's lessons. One of them was this: don't ever be bitter. Just keep doing your best, even when things aren't looking so good. Even when you are lying, helpless and twitching, on the floor of a football stadium, unable to move your limbs, unable to take a deep breath. Even when you drift to the surface from a deep, chemically induced sleep 2 days later and find yourself in a hospital bed with tubes in your throat and in your groin and machines beeping in every corner of the room and your mother gently rubbing your forearm, asking you through her tears, baby, can you feel this? Please blink your eyes once if you can feel this. First of all, Tim, that's just the worst writing ever. You should be ashamed. You should be ashamed of that offer. I mean, it's so freaking good. So,
that's pretty good material to work with, though. That's pretty good stuff to work with. I'm telling you, I say it's all about the material,
Sure. It's easy to screw up. I mean, we both, I'm sure, had moments where we had really good material and we didn't really deliver in the way we wanted to. That story really stuck with me through the years, and his story stuck with me through the years. I think you were the first guy to get an interview with him post, accident. I was wondering how you did and what you recall from that.
The story came about because for some reason, and this is, he got hurt, and Mark Moravec, the NFL editor, said, do you want to take a crack at this? When we thought he might still wind up as a quadriplegic. And I called the doctor who first treated him. And there's still some controversy about how the treatment was done, but that's going to go on forever. But and the doctor, Andy Cappuccino is the name. He's a spinal surgeon in Buffalo. And for some reason, he called me back. And the reason he called me back is because he respected Sports Illustrated, which, we both know that as you move up the ladder, you get called back sooner by people. And this guy was also nervous about the treatment he had given Kevin Everett, and he wanted to tell his story to somebody. So I flew out to Buffalo, spent the day with him, and he told me the whole story of how that went. And he said, I will put you in touch with Kevin. And you can tell his story. And I waited, Jeff, probably 6 weeks, maybe, before, a couple times the doctor said, hey, Kevin's going to call you tonight. He didn't call. Kevin's going to call you tomorrow. He didn't call. And I was just, sitting in my kitchen, and it was like this, like, confluence of things in life. Like 2 days after my son got cut from the varsity hockey team at the local high school, which was the biggest thing in his life. And it had a happy ending because he made the team the next year and had a good season. But at that moment, it was just like, funereal in our home. And then my phone rings and I look down and it's in a Houston number. And, I just thought, could that be Kevin Everett? And I let it go to voicemail because it was just not the time in my house where I could pick up the phone. I mean, we both know sometimes you just pick up the phone because that's what you do. But I couldn't at that moment because I had a heart sick kid right in the kitchen and I let some time pass. I went up to my office. I called the number. Said, this is Tim Layden, Kevin. And he said, hey, you want to come down to Houston and talk? And, I said, yeah, I'd love to do that. And we made an appointment for the next, a couple of days later, I would go down and see him. And, I just remember I dropped to my knees in my office and was shaking my fists, all by myself, because I knew I was going to get this interview that I'd been dying for. Several weeks, and that it was going to be good. You could tell from talking to him that he was going to be a good interview. And obviously, again, back to what we talked about, massive life experience, near death experience, it was going to be really good. And I knew it, and I just had to go put in the time, and spend some time with him in Houston and get the story and then come back and write it. And, super memorable. And he was also a guy who was, he was dealt a super tough hand. I mean, he went from, that top 1% of humans in terms of their physicality to somebody whose muscles don't work anymore. And he's doing okay now, but he's never going to be whole. and he knew it then. So it was, right, again, pretty amazing, you know, connections, and it's something that people don't always understand when they see a story, and you do because you've been on, you're on the other side, and so am I. But as soon as I see a story like that, I think, how did this happen? How did this writer, you know, how did we get to the point where I'm reading this piece? You know, right, and sometimes, you know, it had to be hard, you know, that a lot of hoops were jumped through for this to happen. And, right, that's been the case on a lot of stories.
And sometimes it's just making the extra call that other people don't make.
For sure. It can be serendipitous. It can be just good fortune. It can be who you work for. It can be knowing somebody who knows somebody, or it can just be staying after it. You know, I mean, back to what we talked about at the beginning. I mean, that's what most of these stories are, staying after it. Just calling, digging, and then we don't all write it the same way afterward, you know, but that's, or at the same level, but you know, that's what you do.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, quick word from our sponsor. Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey. And I thought it'd be fun to pretend we're living in 1987 when I was your age. Is that good?
Okay.
All right. So you know what's dope and rad?
That new Def Leppard cassette tape?
No.
Hanging out at the Jefferson Valley Mall and having an Orange Julius?
No.
Getting home at 8 o'clock so we can watch Different Strokes, Silverspoon's Love Boat, and Fantasy Island back to back to back to back?
Definitely not. What's dope and rad is going to 503-sports.com, where the kings of throwback sports merchandise peddle all sorts of amazing hats, t-shirts, jerseys from leagues like the USFL, the WFL, and the XFL. It's all handcrafted and reasonably priced.
What does that have to do with 1987?
Grody. Gag me with a spoon.
That makes no sense.
As if.
You wrote a lot, obviously, of track and field Olympics. And I was kind of wondering, I kept finding stories with your byline about Marion Jones, when Marion Jones was coming up, the great American sprinter, Marion Jones' rise, Marion Jones was amazing, Marion Jones and Maurice Greene. And then it turns out she was kind of a fraud and she was cheating. Obviously, a lot of athletes do, but she was among them. And I wonder, I've never asked another writer this, at least not on this podcast, because I covered baseball during the steroid era. And I remember covering Barry Bonds' home run chase and kind of thinking afterwards, well, that was a whole lot of nothing. Like, that was kind of meaningless, because what a waste of time. And I wonder, you're watching Marion Jones, you're dazzled by Marion Jones, then you find out it was all kind of a fraud. Are you ever angry about it, or do you just view it as a story to cover however it unfolds?
No, I kind of like, I've made my peace with the drug stuff, which is I try to inject a certain amount of skepticism into anything I write where that might be in play. I did it with Marion Jones not quite from the start, but when she was like a superstar phenom when she was 15, 16 years old. So it wasn't out of the realm of possibility that she could be the next great thing and maybe, you know, run almost as fast as Florence Griffith Joyner, who, you know, that's a bad thing to do, actually. But, you know, when we found out that her boyfriend was a shot putter, a lot of us that are close to that sport, and we're 22 years ago now, when we found that out, it was like a red flag, you know, the size of one of those flags they put on the football field before NFL games, you know, with everybody holding a piece of it or whatever. It was like, shit, this could go bad, you know. But then, Jeff, the weird thing was the big piece I wrote about her in 1998, it was like a 10-page feature in SI, which actually got bumped off the cover by Sammy Sosa right in the middle of all that stuff.
That's awesome.
But it wasn't so much the story. I ran into problems with the story because I went to see her and she was clearly not, you know, she was uncomfortable being interviewed because she has a lot of issues in her life. You know, her dad left early. Her mom was very controlling. Now she's married to a very controlling guy who's a big shot putter. And so there were problems, and you could see that she was not, she had some flaws or lack of growth. And so I worried, and then the story was almost reported. And then her mother called me back. And her mother told me a bunch of crazy stories about raising her daughter and, you know, how much she didn't like the marriage to the shot putter and, you know, how her daughter tried to give her a check it was just bad stuff. But I included it all in the story because it really told you who she was and where she came from. And, you know, like it was pre-internet day. So the magazine came out and Marion called me and left me a voicemail, you know, that I saved for a long time because it was so astounding. It was hugely vulgar. It was MFs and CSs and it was just vicious. And a few weeks after that, I was in Oslo covering, doing another feature story, and she was there, and CJ Hunter, her husband, was there, and I rode in the elevator with CJ. You know, CJ's, 6'2", 300, and we got in the elevator, and he said, why the fuck did you do that? And I said, what did I do? And he said, you just killed us, and Marion's never going to talk to you again. And the doors opened, and he got out first, and I said, CJ, you think about who that hurts.
And wow, nice.
And then for the
That's a good moment.
And then for the next 3 years, I covered her without access to her, which was one of the most liberating things I've ever been through. Yeah. Because when you can write about somebody without needing them, then you can really be honest. Right. Because you don't need them at all anymore, because you're just going to write. And people are going to tell you what they're going to tell you, and you can write what you see, and you can report around. And it was very freeing to not have to worry about whether this athlete was going to talk to me. And I would have preferred that she kept talking to me, but that story was going to end badly no matter what. So it was. When it comes to steroid stuff, I just try to always ask if I have doubts about an athlete. So it's on the record. I've asked Usain Bolt. I asked Lance Armstrong. I asked Marion Joe. I asked all of them at some point, are you clean? And that way, when the time comes, I can use that quote and say, at least this athlete apparently lied and said that she's clean. And is the world the way it's constructed? You can only go so far toward accusing someone, even when it's obvious. And, it's just... With her, it became obvious right around the time I profiled her, actually, when she started laying down all these times one after another and never got tired, and it just looked bad.
Do you keep trying? Like when her husband says she'll never talk to you, blah, 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 and you're for the next 3 years, you're still covering her. Do you still go up to her and say, hey, Marion, or do you just know she's not going to talk to you and leave it alone?
Yeah, I would go to press conferences and group, group interviews, but it was clear that there was no value in, you got to know at some point, you don't want to go back into the spanking machine. It just doesn't serve any purpose at that point.
Yeah.
There are some writers who'll do that just to get a showy no comment that they can use. But I didn't see any value in that. And it was clear that she wasn't going to talk to me anymore. And there was nothing I could do about it. And that was okay. You know, as a writer, if you've been doing this long enough, there comes a time when you're going to write something that's going to end a relationship. And that hasn't happened to me too often, but you definitely know when you're doing it. If anybody does that and says they didn't see it coming, they're full of shit. Because where the line is. And you knew that John Rocker and you were not going out and get a beer after that story ever. Have you patched it up? I can't remember.
No, not even close.
Okay.
Not even close.
Well, but you knew that, right? I mean,
the odds were not great. The odds were not great.
Yeah. I think you usually know. It's very few athletes that are self-aware enough to let you expose their flaws and stay buddies with you. There are a few, but I haven't found many.
What's the angriest? What is the angriest an athlete has ever? I love this question. It's one of my favorites of all time, mainly because I'm a survivor of the John Rocker 99 affair. What's the angriest an athlete's ever been to you?
So, I think it was 1992. I was at Newsday and, I was assigned to do a piece on Steve Howe, who was this left-handed reliever for the Yankees. And he had been with the Dodgers before that, and he was, this guy who could get one or two people out. But he also had a serious drug problem, and he had been arrested for the seventh time in a very short period of time for cocaine possession or distribution or whatever. It was beyond just possession this time. And so Newsday said, we got to do a story on this. He was suspended. It was in the winter. And they said, he'd go out and do a piece on him. He lived in Whitefish, Montana. So I just flew out there. And as soon as I get into my hotel, I called Howe, and he picked up and he said, he just ranted and raved at me and cussed at me for, several minutes about the bad treatment he'd gotten from New York newspapers, and I'm never going to talk to you. So I called my boss and he said, well, see what you can get without talking to him. So I kind of went around town talking to people that had shown up, and he had written a book about his recovery, and there had been a lot of stories done. So I talked to probably 6 or 8 people over the course of 2 days. And the third day, I went to a gun shop where this guy who was a buddy of Howe's owned the gun shop. And I went in there and was interviewing the guy for like 10 or 15 minutes. And then Steve Howe walks in and he's wearing jeans and like an old sweatsuit top. And he's smoking a cigarette and, got, you know, like, sunglasses on. And he walks up to me and says, well, how am I doing? And I said, I'm not sure what you mean. And he said, well, how am I doing? You're going around town talking to all my friends. Is that the way you do your job? And I said, it kind of is, because you wouldn't talk to me. If you'll talk to me right now, I might put this in a different direction. So then he walks up to me and he grabs, you know, like the scruff of my jacket or whatever, and starts walking me back toward a wall. And, you know, at this point, I'm in a gun shop and he's with a buddy of his, so I'm not going to fight back. I'm going to kind of see where it goes. And he gets me pinned up against the wall and he just says, I just want to let you know you better tread lightly or you might just not get out of here. And that's not a threat. That's a promise. And then he just holds me there. He's got the cigarette in his fingers and the smoke is going up into my nose and it's killing me. And he's just really intense and he's maybe high. I don't know. And then he just kind of lets go. And three of us stood there for a minute. And I said, okay, I'm going to go now. And I walked out and left the place and went right back to the hotel and told my boss, I think I'm going to get out of here because this is what Howe just said. And my boss says to me, I won't forget this, says to me, well, do you think he was serious? And I said to him, you know what? This is a 7-time drug suspended guy who seriously got problems in his life. And I'm in his town, like 2,500 miles from home. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and get out of here. Right. And, then I went back and that entire exchange I wrote as the first like 400 words to the story because I thought, that was exactly who Steve Howe was. And, he was in my life for probably another 6 months after that because his case went on and on and back and forth. And poor John Heyman had to go out to Yankee Stadium and get comments from Howe every time I wrote a story with sources from Montana. And, it went on and on. And years later, Steve Howe died in a car crash with a lot of drugs in his system and was just unfortunately, a guy with a lot of demons and struggles who was, at that moment perfectly prepared to, probably to kill me in that gun shop, but I'm glad I got out.
When you, in the months after, do you avoid going up to him? Or are you like, this is not a guy I should approach in the clubhouse?
Yeah, we kind of made a decision that the best way to do this would be, Heyman was the baseball columnist. There were several guys covering the Yankees and Mets for Newsday at that time, but Heyman was the guy who was kind of didn't have an in with either team. So, that goes with beat writers. They don't want to burn bridges. So every time some prosecutor or police source in Montana, which is where the whole case was taking place, every time one of them would call me with a leak of some sort, rather than me going out to Yankee Stadium and creating a scene with Howe, I would just funnel the information to Heyman and he would have to go do it, which, you know, once again, it's not, I guess the macho thing would have been for me to go marching in there and start doing this, but it also would have gotten us nowhere. Howe was more inclined to respond to Heyman, and he usually, would rip me and claim that the source was made up, and this might sound familiar to you. But I just would go ahead and use what John gave me and then write the story. I did go out to Montana once more when he went on trial. He pled basically no contest to the charges. And I was in the gallery that day and talked to him with a group of people afterward, but nothing happened there.
Can you have, when he's going through his struggles and when he ultimately passes, despite the sort of exchange you had, is there an empathy for him or are you just like, screw this guy?
No, I felt terrible for him. I mean, we were long out of each other's lives by then. I mean, obviously when he threatened to kill me and, in Montana, I wasn't so much afraid of him or angry at him. I just respected that he was probably not a stable person and I should probably fold up my cards at that point and go write my story. But you can't. I mean, obviously he was a guy with a lot of trouble and I was pissed off that he treated me that way. But, I came to his town and started interviewing people about him, people that were friends of his and had supported him as he was trying to go through recovery. And, again, I'd probably be mad too. But I think he also knew that he was on the wrong side of that story and that this wasn't going to go well and that everything I was reporting was accurate. And, the people that are people that are in the wrong that get the angriest at you are always the people that you write accurate shit about. You know, that's, you know, that's the way it goes. And, you know, it was just, that was one of those things that we were never going to be friends at that point. You know, there was never going to be a patching up of things. And that was just the way it went. But it was humbling. And I absolutely felt that he was capable of, if I had fought back in the gun shop that day, I felt that it could have gone pretty badly.
Right. The Howe family holiday card was never coming to the Layden household.
It was never coming to the Layden household. It was at one point, the original charge came about because of a confidential informant who Howe bought cocaine from. And I eventually got to that guy, and it's hard to get to a confidential informant, but I got to that guy, and I had to tell Heyman that I talked to him, and Heyman had to go up to Howe's locker. And I remember Heyman telling me, okay, here's the first quote. Layden talked to so-and-so, so-and-so, and here's what he said. And Howe looked up at me and said, how did he find that dirt bag? Talking about the confidential informant. And
that's amazing.
That was the kind of quotes that went back and forth in that story for a while. And it wasn't pleasant. And, you know, a lot of conversations with Faye Vincent at the same time, who was the commissioner. And, you know, it was pretty memorable, actually.
I want to answer one last thing here. You, the first story I called up today by you, it was just randomly, was your coverage of the Kentucky Derby in May. And the headline was disqualified inside the historic decision that shocked the Kentucky Derby. Your lead was, they stood ankle deep in mud on the most famous racetrack in the world, and they stood in the infield grass, and they stood next to the little piles of manure in the long tunnel that separates the saddling paddock from the bowl inside. Churchill Downs beneath its ancient twin spires. They were thoroughbred horse trainers. They were jockeys. They were owners. It was dusk on the first Saturday in May, and a veil of gray twilight hung over the track and over the moment. Misty droplets of rain fell intermittently. The Kentucky Derby had been run for the 145th time, and it had finished, and yet the outcome remained undecided. This story was, it was great. It was really great. And I was thinking, everybody knows what happened in the Kentucky Derby. Either you saw it, or you saw the highlight on Twitter, or your uncle told you about it. So when you're writing about an event that everybody saw, what are you trying to offer?
Well, I'm trying to offer my perspective and my voice and my knowledge of what happened and the reporting that I can do around it. And then also, whenever I do live event stories, and they're always on some kind of crushing deadline, but you do the best you can, you know, that story's written in like 90 minutes. You know, it's like, I always tell people, like, when they say, what's the most important thing about covering an event that everybody's seen? I'll say, it's still time and place. You know, you are in a place at a time when something happened. Convey that. Because the people you're writing for, by and large, were not there. Even if they know what happened, they weren't there. And, you know, a football stadium smells different than your family room. Churchill Downs in the mud at dusk feels and looks and smells very unique. And a lot of shit was happening too. So I tried to just kind of wrap a bow around all that and have people be there. And that was a story where I said what happened, but then I tried to dole it out slowly after that to let people experience what I experienced standing on that track for 22 minutes trying to get the outcome. And, you know, again, everybody knows what happened, but they weren't there. And so I try to tap into that and also report and talk to people and then keep a level of organization to the material. So, you know, you're controlling the material is not controlling you, and then say what happened. You know, it's, that was a cool story to write. I mean, it was a lot. What we all want when we go to cover a game is for shit to happen. You know, one of the first games I ever covered in my life in the business was a high school championship soccer game in Guilderland, New York, when I was like 4 months out of college, and I got sent to cover this, and it was a 0-0 tie, and I was utterly fucked because I don't know soccer, and I needed some goals. So this year's Kentucky Derby, I had some goals, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a great story. Well, Tim, I got to say, that. I am, I speak as a, whatever, former SI guy. I'm happy for you because you sound happy, but from a selfish standpoint, I'm sad that you're leaving SI because I feel like it's even hard to, because we were all in a room. Like there was, everyone was in a room. Every holiday season, they'd fly us all in, and it'd be all these writers in a room, and some of them have passed on, and many of them have retired, and it just feels like holding on to something that doesn't really exist anymore. And I feel like, to me, you leaving the magazine is another piece of a magazine that doesn't quite exist in the same way anymore, and it just makes me sad. So I don't know. It's a sad ending. I don't know how to say it.
I don't want to be part of people feeling that way, but I understand what you're saying, and nothing is the same and nothing stays the same. I think there's still good people at SI, and I think they have a chance to continue to do good work if they're given the chance to by the new owners. We don't know that. But I'm just proud to be, you know, people talk about the history of SI and mention me. If I could have signed up for that when I was 30, I would have given everything I owned. So
yeah.
if that's where I got to, then man, I'm a lucky SOB.
I think you're, as I said before we started recording, I think you are. So if we're talking, New York Mets, we'll do the Yankees. I would say you're atop the, you know, you're right there with Jeter, the all time sort of hit leaders. And I would be like Alvaro Espinoza as far as numbers of bylines at SI. So I feel like you left your mark and you get your number retired. And maybe I get invited back on Old Timers Day and people say, wait, who is that? Why is he wearing number 12? So I feel like you made your mark. There's something.
Yeah, well, I had a discussion with Richard Deitch once where we were talking that same way. And he said, you're an all-timer late. And I said, listen.
Easily.
I'm on like the whatever year Bulls, and I'm Steve Kerr. I'm not Pippen. I'm not Jordan. I'm not Horace Grant. I don't know. I'm just glad I figured it out soon enough to do some good stuff, and I'm still going to be writing. So,
yeah,
you know,
right. Well, thanks for doing this. I really
It was great fun, Jeff. Thanks.
I want to thank today's guest, Tim Layden, for joining me on Two Writers Slinging Yang. You can follow Tim on Twitter @ByTimLayden. This podcast is sponsored by 503 Sports, kings of the throwback sports merchandise. And visit the website at 503-sports.com. One can listen to Two Writers Slinging Yang on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. And reviews are always appreciated. Music is by the dazzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.